Good morning. Welcome back to hour number two of Focus 580. This is our morning talk program. My name's David Inge. Glad to have you with us. The producers, Harriet Williamson, Martha Deal, Jason Croft. He's at the controls this morning. In this part of Focus 580, we'll be talking with a journalist, an independent journalist who is based in Canada, and her name is Hadani Ditmars. And we'll be talking here about some of the experiences that she has had over the past few years as she has traveled in Iraq and gotten to know people there. She had her first experience going to Iraq in 1997. And that was at the time when the country had been under sanctions for some time. She found there that certainly the country had been crippled by those sanctions. But at the same time, as she traveled around and talked to people, she managed to find people who were continuing to live their lives and, in fact, some cases celebrate life by making art and music. In the years since, she has been back a number of times. And we will talk some this morning about what life has been like for the people that she's come to meet, particularly in the years following the fall of Saddam and the entry of the United States. And that is a story that she tells in a fairly recent book. I think it was first published in 2006. The title of her book is Dancing in the No-Fly Zone, A Woman's Journey Through Iraq. And it's published by Olive Branch Press. I'm sure that you can find it in the bookstores if you would like to take a look at it. Currently, she's spending some time here in Champaign-Urbana as guest in residence at Unit 1. That's a program that's based in Allen Hall on the U of I campus. And by the way, if you'd like to know more about Unit 1 and Allen Hall, the kind of things that they do, they have a website. So the easiest thing to do is to go through the U of I webpage, or I think probably if you just put in Allen Hall Unit 1 in your browser, I'm sure that you can find it. Just a little bit more about her. Her work has been published in a number of places, including the New York Times, Time, Newsweek, San Francisco Chronicle, Salon, the London Independent, the Globe and Mail, Vanity Fair, and Vogue, and also has been broadcast on BBC and CBC. She's been covering the Middle East since 1992 and has reported from a number of places, including North Africa, Tanzania, Uzbekistan, Lebanon, Colombia, Indonesia, and also Gaza and the West Bank. Her Ms. Magazine essay on Iraqi women has been adapted for many university courses, and we're pleased to have her here on the show. As we talk, as always, questions welcome. 333-9455, toll-free 800-222-9455. Thank you very much for being here.
Oh, thanks for having me. It's a pleasure to be here.
Just to have a little bit of the backstory on Dancing in the No-Fly Zone, for the first time you went to Iraq, this was 1997, so that was the first time you had ever been in Iraq?
Yes, in 1997, right. That's correct. I went there in November on assignment for the New York Times. And the story of the day was if you remember, the UN weapons inspectors and the cat and mouse game that was happening between them and Saddam and the whole issue of access to the palaces. And I found that sort of official story interesting for a couple of days, but then realized that there was only so far you could go at the official level. I mean, I don't know if your listeners realize what it was like being a journalist in Saddam-era Iraq, but there was a kind of minder system like they had in the former Soviet Union, where you had these, in effect, mukhabarat, secret policemen who, we called them minders, they preferred the term guides, as if they were working for some benign Ministry of Tourism. We would have to sort of pay them for the privilege of being spied on, and they would act as translators and, you know, fixers, but they were very hard to ditch. So I had to sort of find ways around that. And one of the ways that I found was to go to the beauty parlor, for instance, where I could speak openly with women. Because for some reason, even though it was a very secular society and women had a very high status in pre-invasion Iraq and a big role in public life, and half the doctors and half the civil service was women, there were no women minders. So that was actually something that I could use to my advantage, because then I could go off, spend the afternoon, you know, getting my hair done, supposedly, but actually hanging out with the women and having coffee and getting very different responses than I would if I had this minder from the Ministry of Information. Another method that I found of trying to sort of tap into what was going on was to go to the theater. As in sort of Václav Havel era Czechoslovakia, the theater really pushed the envelope politically, where the state-run press dare not tread, and there were layered languages and, you know, double meanings and not so overt criticisms of the regime contained in the dramatic scenarios and the language of the theater. So there were ways around it, but in essence, I really also connected with the culture of the place and the Ruhe Irakiye, this incredible spirit of Iraq and the people, their resilience, their hospitality, their education, their openness, their culture, which really kind of sustained me in what was a very otherwise difficult place to report from.
Yeah. So you actually, in that first trip, though, I think that you were only there for a few weeks because apparently you wrote some stories that were published and the government was not real happy about them. So they invited you to leave after just a relatively short time.
Well, yeah, getting blacklisted was very common in Saddam-era Iraq. I was actually there. That was one of my longest trips. I was there for 5 weeks. And normally you could only stay for sort of 2 or 3 weeks. You had to go in and out on journalist visas, you know. But I was having a good time. I didn't want to leave. I found it a fascinating place. I'm not sure what it was that led up to the sort of polite expulsion. But it could have been a number of factors. One never knew. In police states, they never tell you why. But I did write the first ever, as far as I'm aware, feature in the New York Times that brought attention to the humanitarian cost of sanctions and had visited hospitals and schools. And we're talking about the effect of what in the end were 12 years of draconian, really, sanctions imposed by the UN on Iraq that sadly had the opposite effect if the intent was to weaken Saddam, they actually emboldened and strengthened, entrenched his power because of the sort of collapse of the economy and the civil society due to the sanctions and the devaluation of the dinar and the fact that under the UN sanctions regime, you couldn't really, they weren't allowed to rebuild the native industry and the infrastructure that had been damaged during the Gulf War. So this is why Dennis Halliday resigned, the humanitarian coordinator for the Oil for Food program, you know, who said, in effect, if this isn't genocide, give me another word for it, because, desert often country, not entirely, you know, very heavily reliant on imports, suddenly, you know, really cut off from the world. Things like chlorine for water purification, spare parts to rebuild generators, oxygen bottles, stethoscopes, science textbooks were all among the quote-unquote dual-use items that could not be imported because they might conceivably have a military use. All this had a devastating effect on civil society. So because you were so reliant on the state-issued ration card and literally couldn't bite the hand that feeds you, you know, the possibility for dissent declined dramatically, and Saddam had even more power and control over the civilian population in a way than before.
Yeah. Well, there certainly in the years coming up to the U.S. invasion, and there certainly were people that were raising questions about the effect of sanctions, mm-hmm. and was making just the very point that you do, mm-hmm. saying that if what we're trying to do here is put pressure on Saddam and the regime. Mm-hmm. It's a failure because people who were highly placed, influential, had money, you know, their lives were just fine. They were going on and doing whatever they mm-hmm. want to do, that it wasn't doing what we want. But what it was doing was making, for your average Iraqi, mm-hmm. making life extremely difficult mm-hmm. and that it was having profound effects on people's health and their life expectancy and the life and the health of women and children mm-hmm. Particularly. So here you had the opportunity to go and spend not just this first time in 97, but subsequently a number of other times mm-hmm. to go and spend time there to try to get to know people, to talk to them about, you know, what their lives were like and how they were dealing and what the sanctions meant. What can you talk about what life was like for average mm-hmm. people in those years mm-hmm. leading up to the American invasion?
Mm-hmm. Well, I think it's very important to talk about those 12 years of sanctions because, I mean, we have to look at Iraq in the long term. And I know some people in this country have short memory spans or attention spans politically, but Iraq is a country that has weathered so much in the last three decades. I mean, the eight-year war with Iran, you know, where I think the Americans in the end were backing both sides, but initially Saddam, you know. I spoke with a student actually at Allen Hall who said his father, his uncle was a fighter pilot. I mean, he was an American Air Force pilot, but he was training Iranian pilots in the 80s at the same time as America was arming Saddam in the war against Iran. So I think, you know, we can't underestimate the devastating impact that that war had on Iraqi society. It wiped out a generation of young men in Iran as well. Mm-hmm. Then that was followed by the invasion of Kuwait, the Gulf War, where in violation of several Geneva Conventions, there was rather indiscriminate bombing of water purification plants, sewage treatment plants, civilian infrastructure. That was followed by 12 years of draconian sanctions. So we're looking at, okay, the effect that all this had on the physical infrastructure of the country, but also that the culture and society have sustained extensive damage. This whole generation of angry, unemployed young men that came of age knowing only Saddam and war and sanctions. I mean, it's very important to understand all this context, to understand what's going on now. You know, a country is invaded that's just, you know, almost already a failed state. And then the army and the police force are disbanded and billions of dollars of reconstruction money go missing, mysteriously. You can read about it in Vanity Fair this month. Excellent article. So there's no real rebuilding of infrastructure. Civil society is falling apart even more. Iraq and Iraqis are at an incredibly vulnerable stage right now. I mean, they've lived through so much and sustained so much damage to their culture and society. But the sanctions really helped finish off what the Iran-Iraq war did, which was to wipe out the middle class. There was a 1,000% devaluation or something of the dinar. People's salaries went from $500 a month to $5 overnight. You know, the book market in Baghdad, which was a famous place where poets and writers and booksellers would go, it was very common to see academics selling off their entire collection of Walt Whitman, actually, who was quite one of the American authors that was quite popular in Iraq, just to pay for basics like food and medicine. You would see people selling their living room furniture to pay for a child's operation. We're talking about, you know, a country that was a wealthy, secular, middle-class nation that had one of the best public health and education systems in the Arab world, and all that was just collapsing under sanctions. And as I said before, the sanctions really entrenched Saddam's power because people were so desperate, reliant on the state ration card, could not bite the hand that feeds them, literally. I think that for some reason the effect of the sanctions is often underestimated when you look at the chaos that's unfolding today in Iraq. But mm-hmm. It's an important component in understanding what's going on.
Well, so then given that, I think that part of the theme in the book mm-hmm. is, well, what do people do living under those conditions, either then pre-invasion or post-invasion, mm-hmm. to try and actually have some life,
right?
To get, you know, to sure. to cultivate, to preserve mm-hmm. the spirit mm-hmm. that gets you to get from
yeah.
one day to
yeah,
the next.
Exactly. Well, people would often ask me, like, how can you keep going back to Iraq? I mean, what a terrible place. It must be so difficult. And of course, it was difficult for average Iraqis to live under the sort of twin tyrannies of Saddam and sanctions, and which, you know, had this symbiotic relationship, as I explained. And it was dark and it was difficult and there was incredible hardship. But the thing that sustained Iraqis, I think, and the thing that sustained me even as a person who was living there and writing about it, was this incredible depth of cultural resilience that Iraqis have. There is such an old culture, and there's always that awareness of the fact that it was the cradle of civilization and the Sumerian and Babylonian and Islamic heritage. But beyond that, you know, let's look to the 70s, which was sort of the golden age in Iraq, because the oil industry was nationalized. Revenues were used to build up the health and education systems, public art, theaters were built. There was a big jazz scene in the 70s in Baghdad. there was music, and one of the oldest orchestras in the Arab world is the Iraqi National Orchestra. But when I was there in the 90s, even though things were falling apart at the seams, there was still a lively theater scene. There was still the Baghdad Philharmonic playing away, on even if it was, you know, broken violin strings and cracked reeds. There were still weddings and parties and makam, the quintessential Iraqi sung love poetry that you would hear everywhere. I remember a Canadian poet telling me that he had been invited to attend in the 80s, at the height of the Iran-Iraq war, the Baghdad Poetry Festival. And he said he went out for a walk one night, which you could do in Baghdad in those days without being mugged or killed, and the streets were deserted. And he became alarmed, and he went back to his hotel, and he said to the night deskman, "What is going on? There's nobody out there. You know, it's 8:30 at night." And the night deskman said, no, don't worry, everything's fine. It's just that the national poetry competition is being broadcast on Iraqi television live, and everybody's at home watching that. So, you know, in Canada, it would be the hockey game. But in Iraq, poetry was the priority, you know. And I'll be talking about that tonight in my lecture on the death of culture in Iraq, because I think that one of the tragedies is that this lively secular culture, which existed, I was talking about the Iran-Iraq war, but this was still a reality in 90s-era Baghdad under sanctions in Saddam. There was, you know, 100 new art galleries that opened in the last years of the 90s. There was a lively theater scene, and usually, one of the few positive twists on the embargo was that it caused this kind of theater renaissance in Baghdad. There had always been an interesting theater scene there, but with a lot of influence, interestingly enough, from East German playwrights, and, you know, Brecht was huge there, and also Beckett, Theater of the Absurd in a Police State, you know, usually plays well. But because of the sanctions and the dual use clause that I explained earlier, which prohibited things like chlorine and stethoscopes and oxygen bottles and science textbooks and lead pencils and things that could conceivably have a military purpose, but which were often always, you know, also necessary for civil society. Along with all those things blocked at the border was film and film processing chemicals. So that killed the film industry in Iraq, and all the cinemas closed down and opened as theaters. They were converted to theaters. Theater being sort of the essential human expression that only requires sort of passion and ideas and a little bit of stagecraft. And often, you know, you'd be at a play and the lights would go out because there'd be a power cut, and they would come in with candles and keep going on. So there was this lively and very secular culture, you know, with women performers, you know, unveiled on stage, singing, dancing. That was part of the Iraq I knew pre-invasion. And sadly, this culture, which really helped people survive, frankly, under their very difficult circumstances, did not survive the latest round of invasion, occupation, violence. Because of this terrible combination of criminal anarchy and de facto theocracy, people are really terrified. There's no more public performance. There's essentially no more makam in Iraq, you know, which is like having no more blues in Chicago, this essential, you know, Iraqi art form of sung poetry. There's been a de facto ban on live music in a way that there was, you know, post-Iranian revolution. The last people to leave were really the visual artists. And I was in touch with Hannah Malala, who's this wonderful artist who's now living in London. And she stayed on until, I think, just about 6 months ago. And she was not able to exhibit anywhere in Iraq because all the galleries were closed, but she could exhibit in Jordan and she could paint in her studio. She's actually a wonderful example of this Iraqi resilience and spirit, because she stayed until the very end, and then it was just too dangerous and she had to leave. But she actually worked with what she called the tools of destruction. She uses slashed and burned canvases, and she took actual old bullet casings and worked them into the fabric of her tableaus. And she used to also paint on large canvases that she could then fold up and take, you know, artwork that you could smuggle past borders if you had to flee. Mm-hmm. So Iraqis are very adaptable, very resilient, but unfortunately the culture that existed before has either gone into exile or gone underground now.
Let me quickly introduce again the guest, Hadani Ditmars. She's an independent journalist. She lives in Canada. Her work has been published in a number of places, including New York Times, The Independent, The Globe and Mail, Time, Vanity Fair, Vogue, others. She's the author of a book that is titled Dancing in the No-Fly Zone, A Woman's Journey Through Iraq. It's published by Olive Branch Press. She is here spending some time as guest in residence at Unit 1 in Allen Hall on the U of I campus. She has been giving some talks that are open to the public. So if you're interested, they take place in the South Rec Room of Allen Hall. That's at 1005 West Gregory in Urbana. And as she said, she'll be talking about the death of culture in Iraq. That's tonight at 7. So I'm sure that anyone who is interested in hearing her should feel welcome to stop by. And here on the program as well, questions are welcome too. 333-9455, toll free, 800-222-9455. We do, in fact, have a caller here, someone in Champaign, so let's bring him into the conversation. Line one. So, hello, yes.
Yeah, well, I'm glad to hear somebody from the West to speak about this tragedy. And this lady, she's really something special and wonderful to come all the way and talk to us, so thank you very much.
Oh, Afwan.
Shukran. The point which I'm trying to make here, not to address the people who are against the war, but to the people who supported the war and is still supporting the war, and the occupation, of course, and the disaster which happened to the Iraqis. Can you address these people? And hopefully these people, one day they will wake up in the morning and feel sorry for the support of this war, which destroyed a nation, destroyed their heritage, destroyed their society. 4 million people are refugees. 1.5 million people either killed or injured because of this war. And as of now, we cannot find one reason why did we go to this war and to destroy that nation. Do you have a word or a statement you can address those people who still support this war? I will hang up and listen to you, and thank you very much for your visit.
Okay. Thank you for the call. Well,
wow, that's quite a question. How would I address the people that are still supporting the war? Well, I suppose what the caller means is addressing people who are still in favor of keeping American troops in Iraq. I'm assuming that's what he means. Mm-hmm. Because it's very hard to undo the damage that's already been done by the series of disastrous decisions that were made, starting from Paul Bremer's decision to disband the Iraqi army and police force and the rabid de-bathification that wiped out all the white-collar workers that were running what was left of an almost failed state after 12 years of sanctions in Saddam. So it's quite a loaded question. But I think that... I don't think, as far as I can tell, that there is still a huge percentage of American people that support what's going on there. But I don't know. Perhaps you could tell me what the actual percentage is, me being a Canadian. Have there been some recent polls?
I'm sure that there are. And I have to be honest and say I haven't looked at any numbers like that recently.
Mm-hmm.
It certainly has taken a toll on the approval ratings of the president.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that there are substantial numbers of Americans who now have come to believe it was a mistake. And that I think, though, that people are very conflicted about what now. There are indeed some people who still support the mission as they perceive it. There are some people who would say, I think, I'm not talking about myself, there are people who would say, speaking for themselves, they would say, tomorrow, all the troops should be out. That's it. Period. Full stop. End of the story. And I think then there are some number of people who are saying, well, I'm not exactly sure what to do because I do think that probably there are even people who would say, I think the war was a bad idea. Yeah. I think that we should leave. Yeah. But I'm not sure. I think there is this fear that if the troops were essentially all withdrawn fairly quickly, that it would be even, I don't know if you can imagine it being worse, but that it would be even worse. So
well, here's what I think. You know, I'm a journalist, I'm not a politician, and I don't work in the Pentagon, you know, or the U.S. government. But in an ideal world, the invasion wouldn't have happened, of course, but in an ideal world, if there was some way to withdraw troops at the same time as they were replaced by a UN peacekeeping force who would really seriously have as their agenda the protection and the security of Iraqi civilians, then that might work. Because that has never been a priority. I mean, let's not kid ourselves. People in the West became aware of the terrible situation of post-invasion Iraq when criminal gangs began to kidnap and kill Western contractors and journalists. But that was a reality for average Iraqis from day one of the invasion. Remember the stuff happens, quote, you know, when people were looting the government ministries and the Baghdad Museum. This was allowed to happen. This, you know, there was a criminal negligence on the part of the American occupiers under Geneva Conventions. You know, occupiers have a responsibility to take care of the security and welfare of the people they're occupying, and this has never been a priority from day one. So if there were a way to bring in a UN protection force, peacekeeping force, that really worked to help the civilians in Iraq, and at the same time, there would have to be an enormous reconstruction, rehabilitation, humanitarian aid effort. And this time, those billions of dollars would actually have to go to rebuild schools and sewage treatment plants and electrical grids, and not go off to, you know, bank accounts in the Cayman Islands, wherever they went. You know, read the Vanity Fair article about the billions that went missing. I think it's an excellent, but damning article about what happened to all that money that was slated for reconstruction. So, you know, if that would be the ideal world scenario, where the billions of dollars that are being funneled into this war effort would be diverted to actually rebuild Iraqi infrastructure and civil society. But, you know, easier said than done, because we have to look at the legacy of the UN in Iraq, which is that for 12 years they were enforcers of a draconian sanctions. They were the embargo enforcers. So there is no love lost there, you know. The Iraqis do not have necessarily a favorable opinion of the UN. We also have to look at recent UN failures to protect civilians in areas of sectarian conflict. Rwanda, Romeo Dallaire, who is Canadien comme moi. I think we all know what happened there. But I would say that that would be sort of the ideal scenario. Now, whether that can happen or will happen because of realpolitik and because of the current American regime's political will to keep troops there, I don't know. But I think that would be one possible solution, you know, inshallah, as they say.
Well, given that the effect of the sanctions were so devastating before the invasion, so as you say, it was a failed state or on the verge of being a failed state even before the invasion. Would, if we had gone around asking people at the point where they knew that the invasion was imminent, if we had asked people, well, what do you think, would we have found, at least for a moment or two, any kind of optimism that if Saddam was removed from power and if the United States came in, that would have made things better? Or even then, were people saying, would they say, you know, I'm very uneasy about this. I don't really think that this is going to make things better. Was there any window at all where people would have said, maybe this is going to be a good thing, the invasion?
Well, you mean in terms of Iraqis and what?
Yes, that's what I mean in terms of
well,
Iraqis.
Well, you know, when I was in post-invasion Iraq from August until October of 2003, it was still possible to find Iraqis who said, "Yes, we're glad that Saddam is gone, and we think this could be a good thing." They weren't in the majority by any means, because most of the women I talked to just said, "This is horrible. We can't." You know, we have to. My friend Ahlam, the war widow, single mother whose husband died in the first Gulf War in the Highway of Death. You know, she had to pull her 13-year-old daughter from school because she couldn't guarantee her safety going to school and back. That was the end of her daughter's formal education. You know, you talk to people like that, they'd say things were better under Saddam, even back in 2003, because of the terrible security situation. But it was still possible to find people. For instance, one young artist I interviewed who said, "I think for the first time, the interests of the Americans and the Iraqi people are running parallel," you know. But that was squandered. That was that initial possibility of any kind of goodwill existing was squandered by the fact that from day one, as I said, there was no concern apparently on the part of the U.S. for civilian security, safety, for reconstruction, for humanitarian issues, for even involving Iraqis as workers, you know, in the new Iraq. There were foreign workers that were brought in on the cheap, you know, from South Asia and different places to run things. Things were, you know, flown into the green zone straight from Middle America. There wasn't even any attempt to sort of engage local business or commerce. There was this very colonial setup of the CPA living in this in La La Land in the Emerald City, you know, as per the book title, the Washington Post reporter, living in this closed off world. They really had no idea what it was like outside of the green zone. And I met these people. I mean, if you read the book, you'll see that when I flew into Baghdad, my seatmate was the head of the CPA for Baghdad. And he was an old State Department hand who'd, you know, been in Bolivia and El Salvador and Nicaragua and spoke fluent Spanish but no Arabic and really had no idea about Iraq, you know. And I had to sort of explain things to him on the plane. Like, I asked him, do you have any program in development for helping Iraqi women transition into the quote-unquote new Iraq? And were you aware that, no, we don't have any, but were you aware that half the civil service was women and half the doctors were women and that they had a very important role in public life? And, I mean, he just knew nothing about Iraq. So I was surprised even then in the early days of the invasion at this disconnect between the CPA and the Iraqi people who, you know, had to live with the effects of this invasion and occupation.
Let's talk with someone else here. We have another caller in Urbana, line one. Hello.
Hello.
Yes.
I've had a suspicion for some time that had there been no invasion, and if the sanctions had been modified, made less draconian, the Saddam's days were numbered.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Couldn't have lasted much longer.
Mm-hmm.
And that he would have been overthrown and there would have been a much better chance of a democracy evolving. There was a middle class and an educated middle class.
Mm-hmm.
Would you comment?
Yeah, no, I think that's a very important point. You know, people always talk about, when I've done so many interviews about the war and the invasion, and people always want to frame it in an either-or context. Like, well, are you saying it was better under Saddam, you know, if I talk about how bad it is now? But actually, you know, there were other alternatives than illegal invasion and occupation. There were diplomatic alternatives that weren't explored. And this alternative that you're talking about an alleviation of some of the more draconian sanctions, you know, a lot of people talk about that, that what would have happened if the Iraqi economy had been allowed to rebuild, if Iraqi industry had been allowed to rebuild. You know, a lot of Iraqis said to me under sanctions, they said, if the Americans hate Saddam so much, why didn't they make, as part of the ceasefire arrangements in after the first Gulf War, why didn't they make free elections part of that? Because he was at his lowest popularity point after the eight-year war with Iran and then the invasion of Kuwait and then the Gulf War. He would have been voted out. But there was this policy of containment, you know, et cetera, I think you're familiar with. But really, you know, I think you have a point, because I don't think it's rocket science. If you want to build a peaceful democratic society, you need an educated middle class. So if people are in a society that's being crushed economically by an embargo, as I said, you know, earlier, they're less likely to bite the hand that feeds them. The possibility for dissent declines dramatically. If you empower people economically, then the likelihood of a corrupt, dying regime staying in power diminishes. But, you know, that's such a what-if scenario at this stage. But it's, you know, certainly an interesting point and an important one. There were other alternatives besides illegal invasion.
It seems to me that the Bush administration never really cared about democracy. Their sole interest was controlling the oil supplies.
Mm-hmm.
And setting up a puppet government that they could rule, well, free, what was his name, Pearl's friend, Friedman, was talking about a 50-year occupation.
Mm. Well, I mean, oil was always a priority, even under sanctions. I don't know if people realize that actually Chevron, I think, was one of the biggest importers of Iraqi oil under the sanctions. And I remember I was in Iraq during the Desert Fox, the three-day bombing campaign instigated by Clinton in 1998. Now, interestingly enough, that bombing campaign, which had a terrible toll in terms of civilian casualties, but luckily it was only for 3 days, but also marked the stepping up of rather indiscriminate bombing on the part of U.S. and U.K. warplanes in the so-called no-fly zones. People seem to forget that there was this sustained bombing campaign even before the invasion. Leading up to Desert Fox, interestingly enough, I met a French oil executive, an Alf-Aquitaine oil executive, in the coffee shop at the El Rashid a couple of days after the Desert Fox bombing campaign. And he had a fresh copy of Le Monde, which I was eyeing. So we started to chat. And he said, you know, les Américains sont des hypocrites, he said. You know, I was in the Ministry of Petroleum 2 days before Desert Fox, and it was full of Mobil and Exxon executives. So it was business as usual for the oil industry. I mean, that didn't really stop. And, you know, there's all kinds of terrible cases now of, for instance, some Iraqi Americans who were fierce opponents of Saddam but ran charities that brought in medical supplies and things that were lacking under sanctions, you know, into embargoed Iraq, who are now in jail or being prosecuted on these trumped-up sanctions-busting charges, when in fact, you know, Mobil and Exxon executives were there. And U.S. and U.K. Surveillance photography was very sophisticated, and they knew exactly which oil tankers were going in and out at any given time. So, yeah. Business carried on as usual in that respect. But now, in terms of a 50-year occupation, I don't know. But certainly this bill that was passed recently, in effect, calling for, I think, up to 90% foreign ownership of Iraqi oil is seriously disconcerting, as is this plan to partition the country, which would, in fact, cause further ethnic cleansing and sectarianism and weaken Iraq economically and leave it even more vulnerable to foreign oil companies.
I want to hope the caller would indulge me, because we have only about 10 minutes left and I have another caller I want to get to. But just to pick up on the points you make, do you think, or do people in Iraq think, that it can indeed be a viable state given that there are these major divisions, particularly between the Kurds in the north, who would just as soon have their own state, along with Kurds in Turkey and mm-hmm. so forth, an ethnically based Kurdish state, mm-hmm. and that then, particularly in the south, but in a lot of the rest of the country, the majority are Shia,
mm-hmm.
And then we have the minority Sunni, I think some people would say that can't be a state, and that perhaps we should actually think about making de jure what is de facto, and that is really some kind of a three-state solution.
But this is an American idea, this fantasy map of Iraq being neatly divided in three parts, the Kurdish north, the Sunni middle, the Shia south. Mm-hmm. I mean, what does someone like Joseph Biden know about Iraq? Excuse me. But, you know, I mean, we're talking about carving up Americans who instigated the illegal invasion and are continuing to brutally occupy a sovereign country, now want to just arbitrarily carve it up. I mean, this is a huge problem. You know, you think it's bad now. This will cause huge increase in sectarian violence. It will weaken the country. It will leave it more vulnerable to foreign oil companies moving in. This is something that over 70% of Iraqi people do not want. They do not want their country divided along sectarian lines. Can you imagine this happening in the United States? Someone invades America, occupies it brutally for a number of years and then decides to just carve it up arbitrarily, or comes in and says, I mean, and this is going back to the whole problem, which is that democracy is not what has been wrought here, but this sort of horrible ethnocracy at its worst. And to put it in terms that American listeners might be able to understand, imagine if someone invaded the United States and went to a country like, I don't know, San Francisco and said, okay, all the blacks have to live over here and all the whites here and all the Asians here, and you have to vote according to your ethnic bloc. This is not a recipe for peace and democracy. This is a recipe for further destabilization and for the Lebanization of the country.
Hmm. I have another caller here, rather than I'm making them wait. We'll get to them. Bolingbrook, this is line four. Hello.
Hello. Good morning. You know what? I disagree with you. I'll tell you why. I have friends of mine that are over in Iraq, and one just came back, and he's been over there several times. It's an ongoing thing. And you're getting a lot of media hype, if you will, on things that go on there. It's all one-sided. It's very one-sided. In fact, I wished he was with me in the truck right now, all right? He could tell you a little bit, a thing or two, about what's actually going on in there.
Your friend is a soldier?
Yes, he is a soldier. He's been a soldier. He's a sergeant. There's one guy's a sergeant. Another one's a colonel.
Mm-hmm.
Colonel's home from for right now. In fact, he's due to retire. He's up for retirement. So.
And where are your friends based? Where are they, in Baghdad? Are they in Basra? Where are they?
Oh no, I mean he's. I don't know where exactly. He's all over. He mm-hmm. didn't say. He can't really divulge a lot of stuff. I can just tell you that. You know, from what every single soldier that I've ever talked to,
mm-hmm.
and not just those two, I travel a lot. I purposely make sure I ask them how they feel of it. And 100% of the time, I get a total different reaction than what you're hearing on the, we're doing a good thing. We're doing a good thing. All right. Now, that's not brainwashing. If 100% of the people are saying that, given that we went in the way we did, sure, I can see where everybody, is up in arms. You know, and I can almost guarantee you that if it was the left that went in there, the left wouldn't be saying as what they're saying now. The point being, there's mm-hmm. a lot of screw-ups over there.
Mm-hmm.
It's politically run. It's not run by the soldiers, and this is my big problem,
mm-hmm.
because that is a fact, too. The colonels and the generals out there are not allowed to do certain things, and this is where a lot of people are relating it to Vietnam, because it's a political war.
Mm-hmm.
It's not a war for military people. Everybody is trying to point the finger at one another
mm-hmm.
instead of getting the job done. And I got to tell you, no matter how you look at it, if we pull out of there tomorrow,
mm-hmm.
it's going to be worse than when we went in. All right, now we made a mess. We don't pull the plug on it. All right. That's the biggest thing we don't, and I'm not a Republican.
Do you think that Americans should be obligated to pay war reparations then for the damage they've done to a sovereign nation through illegal invasion and continuing occupation? Are you in favor of war reparations?
I'm in favor, for all the damage they have done to this country, to our country, by having terrorists come over here, yeah. Because if we're going to do, sure.
Iraqi terrorists coming to America, what would that be? Who are they?
Iraqi terrorists, every terrorist that's been in the Middle East ought to pay reparations to this country. End of story.
Oh, really? Even the ones that were funded by the Americans? That's interesting.
Tit for tat. See, the point being, okay, I'm not a leftist. I don't go for wars. I'm trying to explain this the best way I know, okay? We tend in America, we're fat and sassy. I have relatives all over the world. They don't. I'm first generation American, and I can tell you that the ideas of what is going on though are totally different from what you're saying. So you're one person, I'm one person. You know.
Yeah. Well, if I could just interject here. I mean, thanks for sharing your comments with me. I have to say that I think, I agree with you that there's a lot of hypocrisy on the part of the Democratic Party in terms of this war, because most of them voted for it. And, Clinton was the instigator of Desert Fox, and the U.S. was the, one of the embargo enforcers under the Democrats and the Republicans. So, I hear what you're saying. And also, in terms of soldiers who are on the ground, it's true that it's interesting. In the early days of the invasion, there was quite a disconnect with the CPA, who were mainly sort of, bureaucrats in a sense, and you know, they didn't really know what was going on the ground. But the soldiers that had to actually go into small towns in Anbar province, whatever, they had actually a somewhat better idea of what was really going on in Iraqi society. So I think that's always the case, you know. But I think, you know, there must be a divergence of opinion among military men and women. I can't believe that 100% of them would all have the same homogenous idea about Iraq. but that's interesting, what you were saying. So I also wanted to point out that when I was at the University of Boise lecturing last year, a lot of my students were soldiers, actually, in uniform. They would come to the lecture in uniform, and I was a bit concerned that, you know, about that. But actually, the ones, without exception, the ones that had been to Iraq and served in Iraq, they completely understood what I was talking about because I had been on the ground as they had, and they got it. You know, they had been there, and what I was writing about in my book was what the reality was like in Iraq. But the soldiers who hadn't yet been deployed to Iraq, who were just young kids with no money from Idaho, who were literally dying to get an education, they were more hostile towards what I was saying because they hadn't actually been there. But the ones that had been there really understood the complexity of the tragedy that is continuing to unfold.
Well, this, you know, I want to tell the listener, I certainly appreciate his comments, and I think that it goes back to what I was trying to say earlier, that I think that there are probably a lot of Americans who would say, yes, we think now this probably was a mistake. Yeah, certainly a lot of mistakes were made. We maybe handled this not in the best way. And yes, we think that with some dispatch, troops should come home. We don't want more Americans to die. But it still gets it back to that point that says, well, okay, what do we do now? I mean, what is the best way to leave and minimize the what is already a bad situation? Mm-hmm. What's the best way to leave and try not to make things worse? And I think probably everybody figures that it almost doesn't matter what we do and how we do it, things will get worse. I mean, it's not, seems to be really no good solution.
Yeah. Well, I mean, who's created this terrible lack of security in the current situation, and how was it created? You know, there has to be some responsibility taken for that. But as I said, in an ideal world, if there were some way to have a troop withdrawal as those troops were replaced with UN peacekeeping forces that actually had teeth, that could actually do things, unlike in Rwanda, to quell the violence and make security for Iraqis, for civilians, a priority, which has never been a priority from day one of the invasion and occupation.
We're almost at the point where we have to finish. I know that you have gotten to know a number of people in the reporting trips that you made in Iraq. Some of those people ended up leaving the country.
Mm-hmm.
And then there are some people who are still living there who are trying to continue to live. Either they can't leave, or they're making their way somehow in the new Iraq. What do people like that think is going to happen? I mean, what do they think that the next 10 or 15 years might be like? Is there a way to...
Well, Iraqis are literally dying to get out. I mean, there's the caller earlier who said there's millions of refugees. And this is a huge international humanitarian crisis, the refugee problem. And I'd like to speak to that briefly because we haven't really discussed it yet. Mm-hmm. But America actually took in more refugees from Iraq under Saddam than they do now. Countries like Sweden that have had nothing to do with the invasion or occupation are the highest per capita country in terms of, you know, bringing in refugees from Iraq. Iraqis are desperate. They're the new Palestinians. I think that Americans should be concerned about the long-term effects that this could have in terms of destabilizing the region. I think that Iraq needs emergency humanitarian aid. If the billions of dollars that were going into the war effort were actually put into civilian infrastructure, as they were supposedly, you know, going to do at post-invasion, that this would this would be something, at least, if America started to take in more refugees, as I think they're morally obligated to do. Go to Syria, go to Amman, see what kind of stress and tension this huge refugee problem has put on those societies, and think about the long-term repercussions. If you're worried about terrorism, you're creating a whole new generation of jihadis who are going to grow up to hate America. I mean, there's a humanitarian disaster unfolding. Smashing a state has consequences. You know, I don't know how else I can say it.
Hmm. I think we're at the point where we're going to have to finish. Maybe that would be the best thing to do, and not launch into another question when there really isn't enough time. Our guest for this hour, Hadani Dittmar, she's a Canadian journalist. She has been reporting from the Middle East since 1992 and has been on assignment in Iraq six times since 1997. Her work has been published in a number of places, including The New York Times, The Independent, The Globe and Mail, Time, Vanity Fair, Vogue. She's the author of the book Dancing in the No-Fly Zone, A Woman's Journey Through Iraq, and it's published by Olive Branch Press. And right at the moment, she is spending some time as a guest in residence at Unit 1 in Allen Hall on the U of I campus, and has given a number of talks for her time here, and she'll be talking about the death of culture in Iraq. Connections between cultural and political realities in the Middle East. That'll be tonight at 7 o'clock at Allen Hall in the South Rec Room, and these events are always open to the public. So if you're interested, you're in and around Champaign-Urbana, you'd like to hear more from her, you can stop by. And then, of course, if you'd like to read the book, Dancing in the No-Fly Zone, you can head out to the bookstore.
And I should point out it's Interlink Books, and Olive Branch Press is sort of a subsidiary of Interlink, but it's confusing. So I think people here know about Interlink. They publish Phyllis Bennis and a lot of interesting people. So.
All right, good. Well, again, Dancing in the No-Fly Zone, Hadani Dittmar. Thank you very much.
Thank you so much for having me.